All right, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Jim Powers.
Hey, Jim.
And I'd like to welcome everybody to the third week of the Big Book Study here at the Eufaula Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if we would, let's take a moment of silent meditation to be used as you see fit. We'll open this with serenity prayer. Serenity prayer?
God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. All right. What we've done so far is we're up to about page 11 in Bill's story. And to recap a little bit from last week, you know, we went through the doctor's opinion, and Dr. Silkworth was talking about the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body. And all the way up, like I said last week, until page 64, it talks about mental and physical allergy, the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body. But really, when he gets to page 64, it says right there, "For we have been not only mentally and physically ill, but we've been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out physically and mentally." Okay? So what we really have to do is to get well. We really have a threefold disease, and we have to get past that mental part, and we don't get past that mental part until we get past the spiritual part, because this is a spiritual program. And I want to read something out of AA Comes of Age, because it was something that was important about why the doctor, and AA Comes of Age is when Bill turned over the reins in 1955, and he wrote this book to the Alcoholic Foundation at the time. It's now called GSO. But one of the reasons that they wanted to have the doctor start the book was, as we look back over the early scenes in New York, we saw often in the midst of them the benign little doctor who loved drunks, William Duncan Silkworth, the chief physician in charge of the Charles B. Towns Hospital in New York, a man who was very much a founder of AA. From him we learned the nature of our illness. He supplied us with the tools with which to puncture the toughest alcoholic ego, those shattering phrases by which he described our illness, the obsession of the mind that compels us to drink, and the allergy of the body that condemns us to go mad or die. And that was why Bill really wanted him to start it off. And up to this point, what Bill's been telling us, and the way he's writing the book, is he's telling us about the problem, and then he's telling us about the solution. And he's going to do that over and over again. The problem, the solution. Problem, step one. The solution, step two. And then how do we get to the solution? And so on page 11, it's one of the only times it's mentioned in the book, Bill's saying, now, Ebby's there, and Ebby's talking to him about religion. And he's shocked because Ebby was never sober. He'd never seen Ebby sober in his life, and now Ebby's got this look about him. And Bill's already said on page 10 that he believed in a power greater than himself. He had often pondered these things, and he wasn't an atheist. And then on page 11, on the top, it says, "To Christ I conceded the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him. His moral teachings, most excellent. For myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult, and the rest I disregard." Now, how often do you hear that in Alcoholics Anonymous? Mm-hmm. You know, I'll do this step, I'll do that step, but I'm not doing this step.
Right.
You know, piecemeal. This program cannot be taken piecemeal. You take the whole thing or you're going to get drunk. And that's not me making a judgment. That's me reading the book and what the book tells me over and over again. It tells me if I don't do certain things, I'm going to drink again. Okay, jump down a paragraph. "But my friend sat before me, and he had made the point blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed," right? So willpower. Human will had failed him completely. And so Ebby had gone to the Oxford Group and had done the six steps of the Oxford Group, which wound up turning into our 12-step program. And one of those, the last one of the six steps, was to carry the message to others. And that's what he's doing with Bill right now. He's sitting there talking to his friend Bill. "Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat." Now, the steps, as written on the boards, just like the traditions is written on the boards, are condensed from the actual steps in the book. Okay, so admitting complete defeat is powerlessness. All right, but we haven't even got to step one yet. We're still working on problem one and solution one. Had his power originated in him? Obviously it had not. There had been no more power in him than there was in me at that minute, and this was none at all. It began to look as though religious people were right. After all, here was something at work in the human heart which had done the impossible. Now, human heart, we're going to learn later on, where people have been searching for God in churches and searching in cathedrals and searching in wherever they were searching. And it'll tell us later on in the book where we're going to find our God. And so keep in mind, the human heart has a lot to do with it. It might be the place where we're going to find our God. My ideas about miracles were drastically revised right then. Never mind the musty past. Here sat a miracle directly across the kitchen table. He shouted, "Great tidings." Now, you know, he's calling Ebby a miracle because Ebby's sitting there clear-faced, clear-eyed, sober. And he'd been sober for 2 months. And he's carrying the message to Bill after being sober 2 months. Anybody ever hear in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, just take your time with the steps? You know, take one step a month. Don't go in a hurry. That's not the way this program works. This program talks about immediately, right after, words like that. And so in 2 months, Ebby's carrying the message of recovery to Bill. You know, Dr. Bob did his ninth step on the day he got sober. What we didn't have steps at the time, but he made the amends on the day he had his last drink. And so standing around and waiting to do this kills more alcoholics because they die of untreated alcoholism because they're just waiting and waiting and waiting. And this is not a waiting or a thinking program. This is a program of action. Okay? I saw that my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots grasped new soil. Okay, and in the next paragraph, he still talks about how he's still prejudiced about God, and he didn't like the idea. It's about halfway down. I could go for such conceptions, and anybody can go for these conceptions, as creative intelligence, universal mind, spirit of nature. But Bill resisted the thought of a czar of the heavens, however loving his sway might be. I have since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. So he wasn't really certain about this God thing. But he could understand the spirit of nature or, you know, intelligent, creative intelligence. But he just wasn't sure about that. And then this is where it really starts. This is where Ebby says, "My friend suggested what seemed a novel idea." And always remember, the squiggly lines, remember I have an 8th grade education coming out of a chain gang, I got a GED, okay, so I call them squiggly lines, they're italics, and I call things little snowflakes, those are called asterisks, and when we get to those, we're going to do that. So bear with me, because this was supposed to be written in an 8th grade level, and so I'm going to read it as an 8th grade level. In the squiggly lines, it says, "Why don't you choose your own conception of God? Your own conception of God." And that, Bill says, that statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I'd lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. Again, squiggly lines. "It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required to make my beginning." All right, so willingness was the only thing that was required to make a beginning. And I told you I'm going to talk a lot about three words: honesty, willingness, and surrender when I do this thing. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, again, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. All right, so he wants this thing, right? And the next paragraph is really talking about step two. "Thus I was convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want Him enough. At long last I saw, I felt, I believed, scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes, a new world came into view." And then he talks about the experience that he had at the cathedral over in England. And then he says, "For a brief moment, I had needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have him with me, and he came." So that willingness to have him with you, he'll come. That's what Bill's telling you right there. He will come if you ask. I've heard people say, God's a gentleman. He never goes anywhere he's not invited. So you need to invite God into your life. Whatever your conception is, and I'm gonna really hammer that home, that whatever your conception is, because it's none of my business. But soon, right, here he is again. Now, he's just admitted complete defeat. He just was convinced that God is with him. But soon his sense of presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly within myself. And so I've admitted defeat, I believe that God, and then I get all tangled up in this obsessive mind, and what am I going to do? Because I don't have any answers yet. He drank. And so I've been ever since, how blind I had been. At the hospital, this is the third time he's at the hospital. At the hospital, I separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment was wise, for I showed signs of the delirium tremors. All right, and the next three paragraphs, I'm gonna highlight steps 3 through 11 as I see them. All right, there I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood Him. And what's that? Step three. To do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, and that without him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend, got the letter F, means it's God right there, friend, take them away root and branch. I have not had a drink since. That's steps 6 and 7 right there. Willing to have him remove my defects of character and humbly ask him. My schoolmate, Ebby, visited me in the hospital, and he had brought him a book, and he'll talk about it in a minute, and we'll go read some of what's in that book. But it's Varieties of Religious Experience, and it's a very detailed book, and you really need to study it if you want to read it. My schoolmate, Ebby, visited me, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. Step 5. We made a list of people I had hurt and towards whom I felt resentment. Step 4. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrongs. Step 8. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability. Step 9. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. All right, that's step 10. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I had to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Step 11. So right there, in those three paragraphs, he's already talking about 3 through 11, and the steps haven't even been written yet. Never was I to pray for myself, except as my request bore on usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measures. My friend promised when these things were done, okay? Now that word done is important because that's doing all 12 steps. He promised when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, a spiritual experience, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems. All right, right there Bill's saying what Evie's telling him. They're not just talking about alcohol, okay? All my problems. That has an S on that end. That means all of them. Every problem you can have can be solved by the Big Book and Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I can tell you, if you have legal problems, I advise you to get a lawyer. If you have medical problems, I advise you to get a doctor. If you have financial problems, you're tough luck. go see a financial advisor. If you have alcohol problems and you're a real alcoholic, read this book, implement these principles in your life, and I guarantee you, your life can change. When you do them, okay? Belief in the power of God plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were essential requirements. Do you remember we talked about this being a program where there were no rules and it was suggested? You know, we're going to see over 100 musts. We're going to talk about requirements, and I told you before there's going to be a demand. You know, so right there it says these in the new order of things were the essential requirements. Simple, but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. Okay? Now, self-centeredness is really my ego. And I'm going to have ego deflation at depth, it tells me. I must turn in all things to the Father of Light who presides over us all. Now, this happened in December 14th, 1934. Now, these were revolutionary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I had never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though a great clean wind of the mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. Now, stop right there. We're going to see that again later on in the book, but I just want to... you to know that this is as Bill sees it, and I think he wrote this in 67, something like that. And he describes what he just talked about briefly right there. He describes the detail. He says, "My depression deepened unbearably, and finally it seemed to me as though I were at the very bottom of the pit. For the moment, the last vestige of my proud obscenity was crushed. All at once I found myself crying out," right? Here's an alcoholic prayer for you. Ready? "If there is a God, let him show himself. I'm ready to do anything, anything." Suddenly the room lit up with a great white light. It seemed to me in the mind's eye that I was on a mountain and that a wind not of air but of spirit was blowing. And then it burst upon me that I was a free man. Slowly the ecstasy subsided. I lay on the bed, but now for a time I was in another world, a new world of consciousness. All about me and through me was a wonderful feeling of presence, and I thought to myself, so this is the God of the preachers. And that's how Bill explains it later on in the book. That's what happened to him. He had an immediate spiritual experience. An immediate one. Now how are you going to keep it? Right? "For the moment I was alarmed. I called my friend the doctor and asked him if I were still sane. He listened in wonder as I talked. Finally he shook his head saying, 'Something has happened to you, Bill. I don't understand. But you had better hang on to it, because anything is better than the way you were.'" You know, the way he was just a raging drunk, and all of a sudden he had something that the doctor didn't even know about it. Dr. Young had told somebody about it, and we'll read about that in a minute. But Dr. Silkworth knew about the obsession and the allergy. The good doctor now sees many men who have had such experience. He knows that they are real. All right, now, this is going to be another step right here in this paragraph coming in later on. "While I lay in the hospital, the thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given to me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, might work with others." What are we calling that?
Step
12, right there. "My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affair. Particularly when it was imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead," he said. And how appallingly true for the alcoholic. This comes in, this next sentence comes in real heavy, because a lot of people say, "Well, this is why I went to drink, this is why I drank, you know, I stopped going to meetings." "For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through the work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead." Okay? So unless he enlarges and tries to perfect his spiritual life through self-sacrifice for others and work, he's not going to survive certain trials and low spots ahead. So Bill's telling us everything ain't going to be rosy. He's telling us that things are going to get bad somewhere along the line. And that if we're not working and sacrificing our personal ambitions for others, we probably are not going to make it. And if he did not work, he would surely drink again. Here he's telling us what he saw in those first 4 years. And if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. Now, Bill is going to hammer over and over about self-sacrifice for others, and when we get to page 61 and 62, we're really going to talk about the root of our problem, because it's not going to be alcohol, it's going to be selfish and self-centeredness. and we have to get rid of it by doing things for others. That's the whole program. That's the whole solution to my alcoholism, is helping other people. That's why I'm here today. You know, I'm doing this for me as much as I'm doing it for anybody else. And then it goes on in the next paragraph that Lois and he started helping other alcoholics to the solution of their problems. He didn't have much work for about a year and a half. And he had, and Bill had a lot of this over time, and some of it very beginning. He was not too well at the time, and it was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. And self-pity and resentment will lead an alcoholic to drink faster than just about anything else. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink, but I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with other alcoholics would save the day. Now, Bob talks about it in another part of the book where he talks about intensive work with alcoholics, all right? And that's in one of the steps, and we'll get to that later on. But that's exactly what it is, that when I work with another alcoholic, I'm not thinking about myself, I'm not thinking about my petty problems, I'm not thinking about my self-centeredness or self-pity, and it's a design for living that works in rough going, okay? Now, the rest of that paragraph talks about making friends, it talks about the fellowship, and I can guarantee you there are a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know a lot of them, who think being sober and being in the fellowship is all it takes, you know? And I can tell you, it takes a solution, and the solution is the 12 steps. It takes the action of the program. Sobriety of the mind and sobriety of the body is not enough. I have to have sobriety of my spirit too. So I have to have the spiritual awakening. All right, I'm going to jump over to the next page. It's talking about how the informal gatherings may often see 50 to 200 persons. And there's one of those snowflakes. So we call it an asterisk, but okay. And so we go right to where it says it. Down at the bottom it says, in 2007, AA was comprised of over 114,000 groups.
Was that 2007?
2007.
Okay.
And that was the last time they had done when they printed that book, that was the last time they'd done a survey of how many groups were actually registered. Now, there's lots of meetings out there, but they're not groups. But in 2007, there's over 114,000. I do not believe Bill and Bob thought this thing was going to catch on like it did, especially with the slow book sales the first year and a half. You know? I just don't believe they did it. But this next sentence, and it is absolutely true. An alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. Our struggles with them are variously strenuous, comic, and tragic. One poor chap committed suicide in my home. I had that happen with me, not in my home, but one of my sponsees did that. And it tells us the two kind of people that it's going to tell us and how it works that are not going to get this program. He could not or would not see our way of life. And in how it works, it says there are those who cannot and will not completely give themselves to the simple program. There is, however, a vast amount of fun about it all. I suppose some would be shocked at our seemingly worldliness and levity, but just underneath, there is a deadly earnestness. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us, or we perish. And I can't hammer enough, and I will, the deadliness of alcoholism. You know, it is a killer disease, and I am doomed if I don't do something about it. I am doomed to drink myself to death. My little brother did it, and I've seen a lot of people do it. This real alcoholism is deadly, and we're going to see that throughout the book. Okay, we're going to finish right there with that, and we're going to jump over. We're going to start chapter 2. All right, and it starts off with, we of Alcoholics Anonymous know that thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill, nearly all of them have recovered. All right, that's the fifth time I think they've used that word already. They have solved the drink problem. Now, it goes on to say, we are average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix, okay? And it's true. I've been in rooms all over the United States, not every state, but all over I go. And when I walk in a room, I look at people and I go, Yeah, I wouldn't mix with them. I wouldn't mix with her. And they're probably saying the same thing about me. But we have the common problem, and we're looking for the common solution. Okay? And he goes on to explain what he means by wouldn't normally mix. But there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. And he's going to describe people who don't normally mix. All right. Back in 1939, most travel was done by ships. And he goes on to say, we are like passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from a shipwreck, when the camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervaded the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Now, I had to have that, I had to have most of this book explained to me, but that part right there, I wasn't really clear about steerage to captain's table and how Bill was writing this. But what he's saying is that in a lighter, ocean liner, the steerage is the lowermost level. So if you're traveling and you're poor, you're traveling down in the steerage section. It's hot, it's where the noise is from the engine. And then as you have more economic clout, more money, you move up a little bit in the ship, you come above the waterline, you come to stateroom, you come a little bit higher, then you get up all the way to the top of the ship, and you have these beautiful staterooms, and there's a captain's table there, right? And it's got fine china and everything else. And what he's saying is, we as alcoholics, when we all at one time crash, when we come together, we're people that would not normally mix. From the low, say from jail to Yale, from the bottom of the ship to the captain's table, all become alcoholics. And we all get the solution and we all get sober through this program of recovery. Okay? Unlike the feelings of the ship's passenger, however, our joy and escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution, the 12-step message. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious actions. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. Right there on the first page of the solution, it's telling about the great news that this book carries, that we have a common solution. All right, the next page. We have an illness of this sort, and we've come to believe it is an illness. Dr. Silkworth explained it to us. It involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. All right, and then it talks about somebody with cancer, but what our illness does, jump down 5, 6, 7 lines, it brings misunderstanding, and this is in our lives, and it engulfs all those lives touched by all whose lives touch the sufferers. So everybody around us, it brings misunderstanding, fierce resentments, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children. All right? We warp the lives of children because they see our alcoholism and they didn't do anything to deserve what we do. And the sad wives of parents, and anyone can increase that list. He goes on to say, we hope this volume, this book, will inform and comfort those who are or who may be affected. And there are many. Now, it goes on to talk about, highly competent psychiatrists have to deal with us, and the wives, parents, intimate friends usually find us even more unapproachable to do this. And the reason is, I've been taught. Now, I didn't go into therapy, and I've told you before, I haven't been to rehab or treatment. But my understanding from those people who go to therapists is when they go to a therapist before they come to Alcoholics Anonymous, they pay somebody to talk about themselves, and they lie. I mean, they don't ever tell the psychiatrist the truth. Do you have a drinking problem? Oh, no. No. Just one or two small ones every now and then. It's my wife. It's just nagging back. It's my job. It's all these things, but it's never the truth. All right.
That brings up, you know, I talked to my sponsors at first just like that, too, and he was the only one that ever, you know, helped sign and said bullshit, you know, straighten me out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And that's yeah, and I do, too. I'm not very tolerant sometimes when they start running off on that, I can see the lie coming. All right, in italics, he's talking about recovered alcoholics. But the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who is properly armed with the facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Unless such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. All right? So, either I know about my problem, I know about my solution, I've done something about my solution, and then when I'm carrying the message to another alcoholic, I can look at him and I understand him. He doesn't even have to talk, and I understand what he's thinking, you know, because I am an ex-problem drinker. I'm an alcoholic. That the man who's making the approach has had the same difficulty, that he obviously knows what he is talking about, that his whole deportment shouts at the new prospect that he is a man with a real answer, that he has no attitude of holier than thou, nothing whatever except the sincere desire to be helpful, that there are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. These are conditions we have found most effective. After such an approach, many have taken up their beds and walked. So, when I'm talking with another alcoholic, they understand. When you're talking to a psychiatrist who's not an alcoholic, he's got no clue. You know, most wives or husbands who aren't alcoholic do not understand us. I have a friend over where I live who asked me one day, he knows that I come over here, he used to be the fire chief over there, and he said, can you explain to me why you want to feel like that? And I sat there and went, no. I can't explain to you why I wanted to kill myself drinking. I can't explain that to you. He had one drink in his entire life. He never drank. And he never got high. He never did drugs. And he asked me, can I explain to him? And the answer was, you won't get it. But if I'm talking to him or her, you get it.
Yeah.
If you're a real alcoholic, you get what another alcoholic is saying. And he goes on to say that none of us makes a sole vocation of this work. Nor do we think its effectiveness would be increased if we did. So they don't make it their job. Very few people make it their job. And what we're not talking about people working as counselors at treatment centers. We're talking about carrying a 12-step message free, because some carried it to you free. I'm not down on anybody who gets a counseling degree and goes and works in a treatment center. I have no problem with that. I love the treatment centers best when they hand them a big book and a meeting guide and say, there's a sponsor right over there, you know, when you're done detoxing. I think treatment centers have a real place. I just, they never took me there. They always took me to jail and juvenile home, so I never got to go to the treatment center. They just bypassed all that. We feel that the elimination of our drinking is but a beginning, okay? The elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. A much more important demonstration of our principle lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. And that's the 12th step right there, is practicing the spiritual principles in all our affairs. And when we get to how it works, I will give you, if you haven't already figured them out, there are 12 spiritual principles for each one of those steps. There's one for each one of the steps, and they're usually one word. But that right there is what Bill was talking about right before he died, when he talked about Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps are not just to be worked, they're to be lived in our lives every day, in our homes, in our jobs, everywhere we go, in AA especially. And a guy talks about, so it's not so important what I do between the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer. What's really important is, what am I doing between the Lord's Prayer and the Serenity Prayer? What am I doing for those other 23 hours of the day? Am I practicing these principles in my home, in my occupation, with my loved ones? Okay. Next paragraph. If we keep on the way we're going, there is little doubt that much good will result. But the surface of the problem will hardly be scratched. Those of us who live in large cities are overcome by the reflection that close by, hundreds are dropping into oblivion every day. Many could recover if they had the opportunity we have enjoyed. How then shall we present that which has been so freely given us? Well, what's Bill talking about doing? Talking about writing the book. The next sentence. So we have concluded to publish an anonymous volume setting forth the problem as we see it. We shall bring to task our combined experiences of those first 80 plus or minus, first 100, and knowledge. This should suggest a useful program for anyone concerned with the drinking problem. All right? So what they've done is they just said, this is why we're reading, this is why we're publishing this book. And I told you last week there is a purpose and an object in this book. The purpose of the book, I had it right there a minute ago. And it's on page 20, and we're just about to get there, so I'm going to wait. Jumping ahead of my nose. The next paragraph talks about that they're going to have to talk about moral, psychiatric, social, religious, and they'd like nothing to do than to write a book that didn't have anybody that would argue with them, and they tried not to have anybody argue with them. Before they printed this book, I think over 300 copies of the manuscript were mailed out to doctors and to judges and to religious professionals, and they wanted their input because they didn't want to offend anybody. And that's what we wound up getting is a book that, you know, really offends nobody except for the person that comes in, and we'll read that in a minute. It's got belligerent denial. On page 20, I just put my, but the word is our. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend on our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. Okay? I am selfish and self-centered to the core. Alright? So, my very life depends. My very life, it says, depends on constant thought of others and how I can help meet their needs. Alright? And I'm not going to say you're right, all right, very much, but I did then. You may have already asked yourself why it is that all of us have become so very ill from drinking. Doubtless you're curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. If you are an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? Alright, and I told you there's a purpose and an object of the book. It is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. Alright, not generally, but specifically. We shall tell you what we have done, not what we have thought, not what we're thinking, what we have done. Okay, that's the second time. Before going into detailed discussion, it may be well to summarize some points as we see them. Now I'm going to read this next paragraph, and I want you to see if you can tell me what this is. And I'll even give you a hint on where it is. How many times people have said to us, I can take it or leave it alone. Why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? That fellow can't handle his liquor. Why don't you try beer and wine? Lay off the hard stuff. His willpower must be weak. He could stop if he wanted to. She's such a sweet girl. I think he'd stop for her sake. The doctor told him that if he ever drank again, it would kill him. But there he is, all lit up again. What is that entire paragraph? It comes from the doctor's opinion. If you read that paragraph, that is frothy emotional appeal. Please stop for the children. Oh, he would stop for that girl. She's such a nice girl. No, I would not stop for that girl. No, I did not stop for the children.
Some of it I said to myself.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Now, these are commonplace observations on drinkers, which you hear all the time. Back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different from ours. So we're going to talk about a couple drinkers here real quick that aren't me. You know, I've talked about chronic. I've talked about I am a real alcoholic. And the first one says, moderate drinkers have little trouble giving up liquor entirely if they have a good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. All right? If they have a good reason, they'll just quit drinking. I had a million good reasons. I could not quit drinking. Then there's a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die in a few years before his time. And here it is. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor, becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention, treatment. Okay? So this is a hard drinker. We talk about a moderate drinker, a hard drinker. Now they're going to talk about me. But what about the real alcoholic? You may start off as a moderate drinker. I really didn't. I started drinking alcoholically from the start, but other people drink and gradually. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker, but at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. And that's, if he doesn't drink, he doesn't have a problem. But once I drink, I lose all control over everything, including bodily functions. The next paragraph talks about being a Jekyll and Hyde. He's seldom mildly intoxicated. He's always either more or less insanely drunk, or he's not drinking at all, but he's never mildly intoxicated. His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature, but little. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, me, yet let him drink for a day, and he frankly becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. Me again. And he has a positive genius for getting tight drunk at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or an engagement kept. He is often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor. Now, I said for a long time that one of the reasons that I went in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous was because of step two. Because I read it as, I have to be restored to sanity. That means that you're telling me I'm insane, and I have a great job, I have a house on the lake, I have two cars, I have a dog, I don't have a wife anymore, I don't have a child anymore because I gave them away. But you're telling me I'm insane. And there's different definitions for insanity, okay? And what they're going to talk about throughout the book about being insane is the insanity that precedes the first drink. And for addicts, it's the insanity that precedes the first pill or whatever you take, okay? It's thinking it's going to be different this time, the obsession. He often possesses special abilities, skills, aptitudes, has a promising career ahead of him, and he uses these gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, and then pulls the structure down on his head by a senseless series of sprees. And this is me here too. He's a fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated he ought to sleep the clock around. Yet, the next morning he searches badly for the bottle he misplaced the night before. And if he can afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over his house. I didn't have to hide it. I knew where my liquor was. My liquor was right next to me. And I always had plenty of it. In the early days, it was somebody else's liquor that I had stole. In the later days, I was making money, and so I could keep as much as I wanted around. But there were alcoholics back then that, you know, if they left it around the house, a wife would get it, and they would throw it down the waste pipe, is what they call the waste pipe of the toilet. And as matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedative and liquor to quiet his nerves so he can go to work. All right? Talking about using sedatives there. Then comes the day when he simply cannot make it at all, and he gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine. They were pretty liberal back there in 1939, you know. I've got a drinking problem. Here, have morphine. You know, I don't know. Perhaps he goes in. Then he begins to appear at the hospital and sanitariums, okay? And it says, this is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic as our behavior patterns vary, but this description should identify him roughly. So you need to be able to identify with that guy roughly by now. And I've got a friend who does these things. He got me started. He's doing one down in Orlando right now. I hope to see when I go down there. And he has another way of saying, you know, they just describe three different types of alcoholic. He says, you know, how you can really tell an alcoholic? You jump down to the middle of page 23. Once in a while, he may tell the truth. Okay? That's a real alcoholic. Once in a while, I may tell the truth when I'm drinking. Why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle with all its attending suffering and humiliation, why is it he takes that one drink? Why can't he stay on the water wagon? What has become the common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? All right? He's got an obsession. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. I'm an abnormal drinker. I react differently. We are not sure why. Once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. They can't answer the riddle. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from a drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts like other men. So as he stays away from alcohol, he can become a normal person, except he still has that obsession. He still hasn't had that spiritual malady cleared. And I use the example of my little brother. Didn't drink for over a year. Okay? In the minute he had all these tumors for cancer, and they gave him 6 months to 2 years to live, the first thing he wanted to do, because he was being monitored for his sweat glands, is he wanted to take one glass of wine. And I thought it was a bad idea. And on the way home, he wanted to buy a bottle of wine. And I thought it was a real bad idea. And instead of having 6 months to 2 years, he died within 3 weeks because of alcoholism, active alcoholism. He was right back where he was a year and 3 months before. Right back where he was in a matter of 3 weeks. And he really, it didn't take him 3 weeks. It took him 3 weeks to blow out an ulcer. And it goes on right here. We're equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens both in the body and mental sense which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. Yeah. For me, I confirm that. That's what happens to me. And it says these observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. Okay? We're back to that mental and spiritual malady. Because if we don't take the drink, we don't set off the phenomenon of craving. And you can ask him why he started, and most of the time he doesn't know. He goes on to say they sound like a philosophy of a man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so that he can't feel the ache. It's just BS is what he's doing. Why'd you start drinking? Well, the wife, BS, you started drinking, you're an alcoholic, you've got an obsession of the mind, and then once you start drinking, you can't stop because you have a compulsion of the body. Once in a while, he may tell the truth, and the truth, strange to say, is usually that he has no more idea why he took that first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses which they are satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts, they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game. The great obsession that somehow, someday, I can control and enjoy my drinking is the great obsession of every alcoholic. Okay? But they often suspect that they're down for the count. Now, how true this is. Few realize in a vague way that their families and friends sense that these drinkers are abnormal, but everybody hopefully awaits the day when the sufferer will rouse himself from his lethargy and assert his power of will.
Yeah.
I don't get it. I don't have that willpower, and I am not going to rouse myself up. I've got to have something else. And the tragic, death, truth is that the man may be a real alcoholic, that if the man may be a real alcoholic, the happy day may not arrive. He has lost control. And at certain points in drinking, of every alcoholic, on top of page 24, he passes in a state where most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. The tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it's suspected. So before I ever came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was an alcoholic and didn't know it. Okay? When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I tried to stop drinking and I couldn't do it, then I understood I was an alcoholic because I can't, and I couldn't, and I couldn't, and I couldn't. And I came into a meeting every day and cried, and I couldn't stop drinking. I just couldn't. And I swore I wasn't going to drink. I swore. All the way home, I swore I wasn't going to drink, and then I drank. You know? All right. Now remember, there's certain things, the squiggly lines, and things like facts, must, and requirements. The fact, and here we are in italics, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. You ever heard anybody in a meeting say, I'm going to choose not to drink today? It's telling me right here, I've lost that. I've already lost the choice. You know, I don't have a choice unless I do something about it. Unless I implement the solution, I have lost my choice in drink. Our so-called willpower, which I had none, becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. And so, if they stopped right there and we didn't have any other solution, you know, I'm doomed. I'm going to die. Because it's telling me right there, I am without a defense against the first drink. And I'm not going to get ahead of myself, but they're going to talk about how we get that defense. Okay, Bill's going to give a couple examples of, and I really in the beginning I just thought, how stupid to say something like that, but then I went and did it, and I realized what he was saying. And one example down there about when you start drinking again is the alcoholic may say that there is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. Anybody ever put their hand on a hot stove? Anybody ever put their hand on a hot stove the second time on purpose?
Negative.
Okay, so y'all aren't crazy. Okay? Just alcoholic. But the alcoholic may say to himself in the most casual way, it won't burn me this time, so here's how. And then he puts his hand on the stove again. Or perhaps he doesn't think at all. How often have some of us begun to drink in this nonchalant way, and after the third or fourth pounded on the bar, said to ourselves, for God's sake, how did I ever get started again? I think every one of us, right? Anyone that's relapsed has, I know that. Because AA will screw up your drinking. Only have the thought supplemented by, well, I'll stop with the sixth drink. Or my case was, oh, what's the use? I'm just going to get drunk. You know, I'll stop when I pass out. And when this sort of thinking, the last paragraph on page 24, when this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid. All right? So I'm beyond human aid on page, way before page 24, but there he's saying, I have probably placed myself beyond human aid, and unless I'm locked up, which I was quite a bit, I may die or go permanently insane. Wet brain. Okay? Unless I do something. These are stark and ugly facts that have been confirmed by legion of alcoholics throughout history. But for the grace of God, there would have been thousands more convincing demonstrations. So many want to stop, but they cannot. All right? And what I'm going to do right now, I'm going to stop for a 10-minute break.